What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Gentleman's Roundtable Body Recomposition. I'm one of your several hosts, Jeff Pacman. And who are you, mate?
I'm Andy Tate, mate.
Coach Tate's in the building. Austin. We are missing Austin. Austin is in Florida right now. I think, where's he at? Is he in Orlando?
Dude, I don't know the names.
I think he's in Orlando because he said he's going to Universal Studios. So hopefully he is on a roller coaster getting the optimal amount of flexion to his pineal gland and enjoying his time in Orlando and getting some vitamin D saturation into his Pacific Northwest pale skin. So anyways, he put some pictures up on his stories. And looks like he's having a fucking blast. It was like, dude, he landed in Florida, and I swear to God, his next story was like 20 minutes later, he's on a fucking riverboat. Like one of those fan boats. I'm like, wait a minute, yeah. Bro. You like went straight from the airport to a fucking fan boat, like looking at crocodiles.
he might have only uploaded like, oh, I guess I was gonna say when he got Wi-Fi, but I guess he's not international.
No,
because that's what you would do if you fly international. You wait till you get Wi-Fi before you upload something. But yeah, I saw him with the gators, and I was just like, "Fuck that shit, mate! I can't be dealing with that."
He didn't.
He sent me. He was holding a gator, a little
no,
baby.
No, are
gator.
You serious?
Yeah, he sent me a picture of him holding a baby one like this, and I was just like, "Mate, you are fucking screw loose."
That's awesome. Well, I think, well, he's thinking about moving down there, so maybe we'll have to go visit him if he does move down there, because Florida's cool. I know Florida gets a lot of hate because of all of the fucking political shit, but I don't really care about that. It's like, you know, it's a cool place. But yeah, anyways, I got some family in Miami, so I need to go visit them too. But
what's the political shit? Not that we're going to get
with Florida, just that they stayed open the entire time through COVID and stuff. And, you know, they never had like a mask mandate and stuff, you know, but it is what it is, man. Like they did their own thing, I guess. But
yeah,
anyways, who gives a fuck?
Anyway.
We are cruising into another week here on the podcast, and it is just me and Andy this week, and which is fine because me and Andy can talk a lot, so you guys will get a good episode here. Andy, what's up with you, man? How's your week been going? How's your training, nutrition? I saw your body recomp transformation, dude, looking lean.
Thanks, mate. That was actually the same photo that I shared actually maybe a month ago. So I just shared the same one because I wanted to make another TikTok post out of it. But I actually think I'm a little bit more lean and a little bit more jacked now than in that picture. So I think I've even gone through a little bit more of a body recomp since then. But I'm still about the same weight.
What would you say your body fat percentage is now?
Based on that picture, I think probably 17%.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
I was gonna say 15 or 16%. Because you can
16.
Yeah, because you're looking lean. Like you can start to see your. I think your serratus is coming in. Like you can start to see those like the deep cuts and like your side abs.
Yeah.
So that usually I think is below like 18% is when you can start seeing those in men.
Great. Perfect.
Yeah.
I'll go with yours.
15, 16. I'll go your with your guess. Guess is what? 17?
I think I guess 17, yeah. I say I was around 20 in the previous picture maybe. And the thing is, like, I haven't even lost that much weight. Like I have lost some weight. Like I was up around 201 pound, I think, maybe a little bit more at my heaviest. But then I've kind of gradually over a long time, actually, not just the 3 months, but I've over the long over about 10 months, I've gone from where I am there, 201 to 203, down to around 193, 191 to 193 now. So around 10 pounds. But it's in the last 3 months, I'd say it's probably, I'm down around 5 pounds. I was probably about 198 when I started properly dialing things in around 3 months. Well, 4 months ago now. and I honestly have been watching the scale more than I should. I know that whenever we're working with clients, we advise don't pay attention to the scale too much. Mm-hmm. And it is a key metric, you know, like it is a metric to tell, like, are you moving in the right direction? And yes, I have been, but like the scale has been hovering around like 193 for a long time now. And I do get like frustrated. And I think one thing is like helps me empathize with my clients who do get frustrated with that as well.
Yeah.
But then taking the measurements, taking the pictures, it's clear that I've gone through some body recomposition. And it's good to remind yourself that it's not just about the scale, although it is frustrating when every single day it's like same weight. But you know, with that said, I haven't been super dialed as much as I should be with my nutrition, but that's okay, because like and I guess I'll be a little bit open and honest, since we were talking about this for about 45 minutes before we started the podcast, but like things have been relatively difficult for me, even during the last 3 or 4 months that I've been going through this transformation. Like I've been having to get up at 5:30 in the morning to train first thing before my daughter gets up. I get my daughter up around 7 o'clock, get her ready for school, take her to school, and then I start work. And she's in daycare, really, not school, but she's like 3 years old. And she doesn't go to bed until like 10:30. 10:30 is a relatively late day, but between 9:30 and 10:30. And so it's already past my bedtime when I get her to sleep, and then having to get up at 5:30 is killer. And a lot of other stuff going on, and with my partner and her work. So it's just been it's been difficult to manage everything. But what I'm super proud of is like I've just been kind of working on what I can, and making small changes. So if I think about when I started 4 months ago, I was getting around 3,000 to 4,000 steps per day. I wasn't training consistently. I was training, like sometimes I'd train 4 days a week, sometimes I train 1 day a week, you know, it was kind of like that. I wasn't really holding myself accountable. It was kind of off and on. I wasn't really tracking my nutrition. In fact, I wasn't tracking my nutrition. I wasn't doing any cardio. And so what I did was I was like, okay, what's the thing that's going to make me feel the best? Training. So I was like, right, let's nail the training. I started tracking as well, and I tried to get as close as I could, but like old habits die hard, and I was like picking at stuff and trying to dial things in. But it's like trying to dial everything in at the same time I found was difficult. So anyway, training, got that dialed. Then I actually invested in my watch because I was frustrated that I wasn't prioritizing steps. So I got my Garmin watch, which has been an absolute game changer for me getting my steps in. I've gone from averaging like 3,000 to 4,000 steps to 10,000, really 8,000 to 10,000 on a consistent basis. So I nailed that. And then I've more recently really started to try and dial in my nutrition, although it's not perfect. And I've been turning some of those steps into zone two cardio. So that's what I've done in the last 4 months. And what my post was about that I made yesterday, I think it'll be a little further along if you're listening to the podcast, but like the post that I made was saying that most of the time I didn't really want to turn up. I didn't want to get up at 5:30 and train.
Right.
But I did it anyway. And every single day that I did it, I didn't feel like doing it necessarily. Some days I did, but like a lot of the time I was just tired. I didn't want to do it. And I didn't see any change on the scale. And okay, my measurements were changing a little bit, but the visual changes weren't so obvious until I took some pictures. And now come out the other end of like 4 months. And now I have these habits of like, I get my steps in, I track my nutrition, I get my training in without fail for the most part. And now I'm adding in some zone two cardio. So I'm getting some cardiovascular health benefits on top of all of that, which I wasn't doing before.
Yeah.
And so yeah. I've really kind of focused on, in terms of like my mental capacity, what am I able to focus on? Small incremental improvements across that period. And it's about what I can input into achieving my goal instead of me just what is my goal and really focusing on weighing a certain amount or something.
Yeah, I mean, for you, I think you also know that, like, being a coach, it's like we can still let the scale mess with our heads, but yeah. But those photos don't lie. The photos don't lie. The scale, it lies, right? It's like,
yeah.
There's so many things that are happening with body recomposition. And I also want to mention, too, that like you took a break from training like pretty consistently, and now you're back to training consistently, which you're somebody who's built quite a bit of muscle over the years. So, like, for you, the scale probably shouldn't be moving that much because you're actually like getting some of that muscle back. So it's
no, 100%. Yeah, like I think that if I was at my biggest in terms of muscular and I was carrying a little bit of extra body fat and then I was trying to build new muscle and trying to reduce body fat, that would be really difficult. Mm-hmm. But I've been able to recomp because I've had like a year or two, maybe not a year or two, but like I've already had about a year of inconsistent training where I've not been really maximizing my potential, and then some time off, and then I've come back from that. And so a recomposition is possible if that's the case, like you're returning from a bit of a layoff. And so I definitely found that that's one of the reasons I think why I've been able to go through this. And honestly, I do feel fucking good. Like my boxer shorts, the elastic is not folding over on itself. Like that happens when I start to, and it creeps up on you. Like, it's not like you just wake up one day and you're like chubby or whatever. It's like, it creeps up. You don't even realize it sometimes. Then you look at a picture and you're like, oh shit, look at how I looked 2 years ago in comparison to now. I've gained a bunch of weight. But like my boxer shorts elastic would like fold over on itself. And now it's not, like now it's like kind of loose. Mm-hmm. Around the edges, it's like, oh, I might have to get some new pants. But it feels good. Like, okay, I'm not as lean as I would like to be, but that's okay because I feel fucking strong as a bloody oxtail soup, mate. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think being strong is underrated and being lean is overrated, man. That's what I think. But I like, ideally, a nice mixture of the two is like where I think I'd like to be. It's like strong and lean. I don't need to be a fucking power lifter and I don't need to be a bodybuilder. I want to be somewhere in between. Like, I want to be lean, athletic, and strong. And that's like, dude, if I can have all those, that's like the ultimate. It's the ultimate NBA 2K. Character, like give me all the stats, baby.
Exactly. And yeah. Mate, did you see my story the other day where I was like, somebody better tag Greg Doucette and do a video on me?
Nah,
I was like, someone better do a "now you're not" video on me because I'm feeling absolutely jacked, mate. I just finished my workout and I was feeling great, and I think I benched like 220 for a set of three on that day, which is 100 kilos, which is a good milestone. I don't know if I've ever hit that in my life, so that's great. And I was feeling super strong, and mate, I check myself out in the mirror sometimes and I'm like, bloody hell, who is this absolutely Judy Dench bloody, you know what I mean, cheeky devil? So it's good. I feel super strong, not quite as lean as I would like to be, but super happy with my progress. And just goes to show you can't just rely on the scale. All good. I'm going to go into a maintenance period while I'm in the UK for the next 4 weeks, which makes sense because it means that I can go out with family and friends and not stress too much about it and just enjoy my time there and then come back and do whatever I need to do.
Yeah, man, that'll be fun.
Yeah, how's your training going?
Oof. It's been, dude, I've been training a lot lately. Coach Paul has gotten us doing like a push pull leg split, but it's push day, pull day, one day off legs, one day off push pull, one day off legs. So it's a lot of fucking training, man. Like, I'm in the gym so much more and I'm in a deficit. So it's a lot, man. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm recovering okay though.
You still making progress? Are you making progress even though you're in a deficit?
Yeah. Dude, I'm doing some hack squats, but I don't have a hack squat at my gym. I've been training at Planet Fitness because there's no good gyms here in Central Oregon anymore now that fucking the gym that I was training at shut down. There's like no good gyms around here, so I'm training at Planet Fitness right now. And yesterday I did some Smith machine squats, basically heel elevated with the Smith machine. And last time was these are slow reps, so like the eccentric is, it's a, you know, 4 to 5 second eccentric, so it's pretty painful.
Ouch. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, you're coming out of the hole, so it's, I was doing sets of 10 with, you know, around like 155 last week. And then this week I jumped up to 195 for 12. So
that's a big jump, mate.
Yeah, it's a big jump. I was just feeling strong. And I also, I don't know if this made a difference or not. Maybe mentally it did, but I put some knee sleeves on because, I've just been having some issues with my knees playing pickleball and stuff like that. Just my knees have been a little bit more achy, I guess you could say. I've just been having little aches and pains in my knees. So I wore some knee sleeves, and I feel like it mentally gave me the go-ahead to go heavier on those. And they felt really good. And the heel elevated, it didn't put so much, because usually, you know, I'll hinge at the hips quite a bit with my squats. Like, I have my squat technique and mobility, my ankle mobility is not good. And so the heel elevation allows me to stay more upright. It takes a lot of the pressure off of my lower back. And I just feel like I can go heavier and a bit more stable. And I can go deeper too. So, it, you know, I get a lot more knee flexion, and 195 was moving really nice. It was probably like an RPE 8 or 9. So it was a very intense set, but like I said, very slow eccentric. If I was just trying to get as much weight up as possible, like powerlifting or something, I'd probably be able to go considerably heavier on those, you know, maybe 255, maybe heavier. But just the fact that they were slow and very controlled.
That's 195. It's heavy for that, for slow eccentric reps with heels elevated as well.
Yeah. And there's no, like, I'm not like bouncing out of the hole, you know? It's not like I'm crashing down and bouncing out of the hole. It's like I am coming down, almost taking a pause and then coming back up. So it's like, it doesn't sound like a lot when you think about a 195 squat, but when you're doing them with the kind of tempo and control that coach has us doing, it's fucking heavy. And I've never had like a heavy squat. Never. Like, that's one exercise I've never been able to get past like 315 pounds. Like, I've never been able to get past a 315 squat. My goal is to hit a 315 squat, whether that's like a Smith machine or whether that's a hack squat or whatever it is. It may not be a traditional barbell back squat, but I'd like to hit a 315 plus squat on some form of exercise.
Yeah. I've never used a hack squat machine. I'd love to. In fact, I've been looking at gyms around this area to see if I can find a gym that has one so I can join it.
It's a it's a great piece of equipment, man. I think it's I think if your gym has one, use it. And a lot of people have knee issues with the hack squat just because they're not used to training in that deep of a range of motion. And that much knee flexion, it definitely can wreak a little bit of havoc on the knees. So I think wearing knee sleeves helps, but also doing something called reverse band technique works really well. And that's pretty much where you tie a band to the top of the machine so that at the bottom of the squat, the resistance is at the highest. And that takes pressure off of your knees so that you can get the most out of the exercise without it kind of tearing up your joints and tearing up your knees.
Yeah, the resistance of the band is at its highest, therefore giving you some assistance at the bottom of the squat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because that's honestly where people kind of experience the most discomfort in their knee joints is like at the very bottom of the squat.
Yeah,
which makes sense.
Yeah, but don't go too heavy. You know, you're gonna have to leave your ego at the door and go lighter than you think. I'm actually working with a guy right now, and he's improved his squat significantly in terms of technique. And when we first started, I got him to send through some squat videos, and he was what we'd call the stripper squat, you know what I mean? Like down and then on the way up, hips up, come up first. Almost like hips come up and then he's doing a good morning pretty much.
Yeah.
And he wasn't getting very low into his squat either. He wasn't breaking parallel. But now he's really dialed back the weight and he's been really focusing on getting good depth, staying nice and upright, and he's had to leave his ego. He's had to check his ego because, like, to take a weight down and not be lifting as heavy as you used to and just focusing on your technique. But still, like, it's way harder. Like, the muscles are still under the same amount of tension, really, because you're going to reach failure way sooner if you're getting more range of motion.
Yeah.
Now he's able to, like, do the similar amount of weight to what he was, but with much greater range of motion, much better technique. Much less risk of injury.
What do you think his number one issue was with like the more hip dominant squat? Like, what do you think helped him get better range of motion?
Well, we got him lifting in his lifting shoes again.
Mm.
And just, I think, like awareness of what was going wrong. You know, some people don't really know what to look for or how to correct it. And so just giving some cues of, try and keep, because what he was doing is he was squatting down quite nicely, but then on the way up, it was like, okay, hips were coming up first. And so it's like, okay, try and think about as you're standing up, pushing your hips forward and trying to keep your hips underneath your shoulders almost. So as you're standing up, it's mostly your torso going down and up and not just like your hips raising and then your shoulders rising. So you want that to all happen in unison where your hips are opening at the same time your shoulders are coming up. So I think thinking about driving your hips forward as you're trying to stand up out of the squat can be a really good cue for that. But also, I don't think he'd been recording himself very much. So the fact that he recorded himself doing that and then can see that, because sometimes you don't know what you can't see.
Right.
So if you can't see yourself lift and you just think, oh, this feels normal. It's like if I record myself doing something, I'm like, I've been nailing this for years, mate. And then I record myself and I'm like, oh, I could fix that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So just like him seeing himself and then getting some lifting shoes, dialing back the weight, thinking about keeping chest nice and open and pushing the hips forward as he starts to stand has been really helpful for him.
One of my main issues with the squat is actually my shoulder mobility with external rotation. So I have a really hard time getting my elbows, getting basically external rotation so that my elbows are stacked underneath my hands. And so this kind of leads me to not really being able to engage my lats. So when somebody has that sort of issue, how do you help them?
Well, I mean, you could just widen your grip a little bit. Mm-hmm. Of course, like working on your shoulder mobility could potentially help. Thoracic extension is going to help with that. Working on thoracic extension and your shoulder external rotation, both mobility and strength. So some banded external rotation or some dumbbell loaded external rotation at the shoulder would really probably help strengthen that position and get you into that end range where you're in, to get into this position a bit more comfortably, as well as thoracic extension. So whether you're lying on a not a lacrosse ball, but a foam roller. I know foam rollers aren't great for always just rolling out the quads and stuff, but I think it's a great tool for working thoracic mobility. So I think that's a really good tool. But then also in the meantime, working on just going a little wider with your grip, because the wider you are, the less external rotation you're going to need in order to grip the bar and be able to sit there more comfortably. And then you're still going to be able to apply some pressure with the lats to that.
Yeah. I also found that my chest, like I have a lot of tightness in my chest. I don't really stretch my pecs enough. So when I started doing the doorway stretches with my pecs, before lifting, before squatting and like getting a lacrosse ball into my, like my upper pec, that really helped open up my shoulder as well and help me get into better thoracic mobility.
Definitely. Yeah, mate, I could do with some of that right now because I'm benching like twice a week and like I'm doing both bench press and dumbbell bench press. And then I'm also doing push-ups. And I'm finding like the more my bench press goes up, the more I'm getting this kind of nagging pain between my shoulder blades. And I think that's just because like I'm so tight in the front that it's just lengthening the back a little bit.
Yeah.
So I have to remind myself to stretch as well in the door. And then I have to break out my lacrosse ball and get into that pec minor a little bit because I'm finding the same thing. And like, my thoracic mobility is not fantastic either.
Yeah.
I've been trying to work on that a little bit.
It's a really tough one, and I think it's something that people don't really think about is being able to rotate in thoracic extension. So like doing some sort of opener, like on your hands and knees, like doing a thoracic opener, doing some rotation at the trunk. It's like, that's so hard for me to do. Just because I have been sitting and working at my desk more, I've found it to be so helpful when I have those little aching pains between my shoulder blades and stuff. Just getting on the lacrosse ball, getting that into my lower and mid traps, you know, just kind of laying on the foam roller and then doing some cat cow, doing some thoracic opening, thread the needle and all that good stuff. Like it really, really helps just to do that stuff throughout the day. So lately I've been setting my Pomodoro timer and then, you know, once or twice a day, I'll do some of those thoracic extension and mobility stuff. So I've noticed a big difference.
You're just living the lifestyle. You are just living the fitness lifestyle, mate.
I'm trying, dude.
I love it, mate.
I'm trying. I think like working from a desk and working from home is new to me. You know, I've always been, you know, on my feet working all the time. So working at home and working from a desk is new to me. So I'm not used to my body feeling this stiff and sore and tight all the time. So I think trying to change my posture, working at my standing desk more, working at my kitchen island, like just standing around, just working in different positions is going to help a lot. And just kind of figuring out like how to not just fucking sit in one spot for hours at a time is just like, it's not good for me. I don't feel good when I do that.
Yeah. No, same. And I find that when I do get stressed, which is quite a lot, when I do get stressed, I feel that pain in my back.
Upper back, more. Like thoracic?
Yeah, like between my shoulder blades. Like think like rhomboids or mid traps. I get this feeling there of tightness, and it's way worse when I'm stressed. Like if I'm stressed about something, I don't know why, but it's just like I feel it there, and it's just like I just want it to like I want it to go. And I'm like Olivia, my daughter, she really pushes boundaries, and she's really stressful. Like if we're out somewhere and she's just like, "Daddy, I want this. Daddy, I want that."
And your back starts hurting.
It starts just like laying on the floor like, I can't move. Cannot compute. Yeah, like honestly. And then like took her to the park. Like yesterday, for example, we went to the park where there's a playground and the running track where I usually go and run. And there's that half of the running track is blocked off. And this is a really busy running track because people just go and walk around. It's a really fucking awesome place to be. And people just go and walk around. There's other people jogging around, but they'd closed off half of it. The inside half was closed off for people that were doing training of some kind. And we'd said to Olivia, we can go and walk around a couple of times and then go to the playground. Cause she also likes, she came to watch me run, do a jog there the other day, and she was loving it.
She's like, go, she likes to try and beat me and stuff.
Yeah. She's like, I go in. Anyway. So like she's darting in and out of the lanes and then crossing over the cones where people are like doing sprints. And I'm just like on the complete edge of like, I'm going to fucking pass out with stress right now because like, you're going to get like splattered by one of these sprinters basically. And I'm just like, Olivia, come here. And the back starts tightening up. And I'm like, anyway, then I'm like, right, let's go playground. And I'm there doing like thoracic mobility at the playground. I'm like giving it the old, rotations because my back is so tight and I'm like, yeah, I need to loosen this off. So yeah. I give it the old rotation for the nation. You know what I mean?
I have a theory about why that happens. Like why we carry so much stress in our thoracic spine. I have a theory. There's no science behind this. There's no research to back this up as far as I know, but I think that when we start to get stressed, we breathe more into our chest and we do these like really shallow breathing. And then that forces a little bit more internal rotation. It forces a little more tightness in the chest and we have less deep belly breathing. We know that deep belly breathing kind of allows us to relax into kind of a more relaxed posture. So maybe just like tightening up and shallower breathing maybe causes more discomfort and pain in that thoracic spine. I've noticed for me, at least, it's definitely when I start breathing more shallow. Because I can really be a mouth breather. I can really be like a shallow breather. And I notice this throughout the day, how much breathing impacts my body. Because when I sit and I meditate for, 5-10 minutes and I really focus on my breathing, I'm like, Jesus, man, my natural breathing is so shallow. It's so shallow. And I'd like to be able to change that to breathing more deeply so that I can be calmed down and have less of those aches and pains. But anyways, that's my theory.
That's a good point. No, it could be, and I don't know any of the science behind that or anything, or I don't know if you're right or not, but I do know that the pec minor is actually a muscle that aids in chest elevation, or it elevates the rib cage so that you can breathe in through the chest more. So that's what the pec minor does. So if the pec minor is doing that and it's pulling you into a more rounded position, because the pec minor also will pull forward your scapula, your shoulder blade, and it will make it tilt a little bit. And if that's the case, and it's pulling your shoulder forward and it's lengthening the muscle in your back, your rhomboids, potentially, if that's lengthened, and it's a stress lengthened, like being stretched is not good if it's not wanting to be stretched. That's what's causing the pain, really, the trigger point pain. So if you're being pulled forward because your your chest is, your pec minor's working because you're breathing a little bit through your chest. Maybe that's the reason for it. So maybe you are, maybe you should be scientific principles of chest breathing, mate.
No, it actually, so when I went to physical therapy for this exact issue, something that we discovered is that I actually walk around with a like flexing my abs constantly. It's a constant thing. So that leads me to not breathing into my belly. And I don't know where this came from. Maybe when I was a kid or something, and I was like, oh, I gotta fucking suck this gut in and, like, you know, look like I have a six pack all the time. So I, you know, I don't know what it was, but I walk around with flexed abs all of the time. And then that kind of led to some dysfunction in my breathing and now my upper back soreness. So what I actually do is I will lay on my side with my legs pulled up to my chest about 90 degrees, and then I'll do some thoracic rotations about 10 per side, really going slow and breathing into my belly while I do it. And I almost notice immediate relief, just because my range of motion with rotation is usually very limited on one side. And then as I breathe into it and as I relax those muscles, sometimes it's my lats. I can feel that my lats are actually the ones that are limiting that rotation. Whatever it is, after doing that and breathing deeply into my belly about 10 times per side, I notice it's completely gone almost immediately. And as I start to get more stressed throughout the day, as I play more sports or pickleball or I lift, it'll go back to being tight again. And then I'll do it again and it'll go away almost completely, almost instantly. Very weird. It's weird, but it works. That's why I think it's tied to my breathing.
Mm-hmm. Crazy.
What?
Have you seen that on TikTok, that trend that's going around?
Uh-uh.
And it's just like, crazy. Are you crazy, girl?
No.
Oh, mate, it's so funny, mate. And me just saying crazy there made me think of it and start laughing. I do apologize for that. But it's having this, like, time. Basically, the original video of this thing, right? It's basically this girl is dipping her like, what is it, burrito or quesadilla in her nacho sauce.
Oh, right? She's just I like, did see that. She's like,
you did see
I'm
that?
Gonna do something. I'm gonna do something absolutely crazy. And she dips her burrito, and everybody in the comments is like, wow, you are so wild.
Yeah, but then someone like someone stitched it. And it just goes to this woman lying in bed. And I don't know, she must be like Eastern European or something. And it's just like, wow, you crazy. You crazy girl. And now
did,
people were
I think
just
I
like,
did see that actually, dude. That's actually crazy that I saw that. That I even know what you're talking about at all.
But now it's a trend. Like, people are using that sound. And people are just doing like, oh, this happened. And it's just like, you crazy. You crazy girl. Oh, mate, it gets me. These TikTok trends, man, it's so, like, Lucy will be like, oh, what are you laughing at now? TikTok. And I'll be like, yeah, because it's fucking funny shit. I shouldn't be on there too much consuming content, but some stuff on there is so funny, mate.
I think as long as, like, the algorithm is next level, dude, it figures out, like, what you think is funny or what you like so fast. And then it's like, oh, we're just going to fucking feed you exactly what you want to see. And it's like, I have a lot of funny videos that pop up on my For You page. Yeah, the algorithm is very good, dude. It knows what to show you.
Yeah. A friend of mine who has a company was like asked, he asked one of his employees to help him figure out something. And they were like, oh, okay, I'll just TikTok it. And what? He was just like, what? He was like, you're not going to Google it. He was like, no, I'm going to search on TikTok how to do it.
Oh my God.
And then they
searched
on TikTok and how to do it. And it just shows, like, is this what we're moving towards now? Is TikTok going to be like the search engine? You know, who knows? Anyway, metabolic adaptation. Isn't that what you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, but before we get into that, I've got another lifting question. I think you'd be a good person to answer this. Mara from Instagram asked, is it best to start on a hex bar to do deadlifts? I'm guessing they mean hex bar, trap bar, same thing.
Trap bar, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Good question, Mara. Is it a good idea to start on a hex bar to do deadlifts? It's not a bad thing to do if you've never done a deadlift before, because a regular deadlift is definitely more complex. Because the thing about the hex bar is two things. You have got the fact that you've got slightly higher handles, potentially. Usually they come with higher handles, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you've got higher handles, so you're not starting in such a low position, which means if you've got any mobility issues or if you're not sure if your back is super straight, a lot of those problems can be alleviated by starting with slightly higher handles. So that's a really good plus. And then you can always progress to lower handles because it usually comes with both on a hex bar.
Yeah.
The other thing is you don't have to navigate around the knee. So what I mean by that is when you're using a barbell, you have to get the knees out the way of the bar to a certain extent to be able to stand up and to have the bar move in a straight line. When you're standing in the middle of a bar that doesn't go through and it goes around you, you don't have to worry about that. So you can really get into a nice, comfortable position without having to worry about the bar going around the knee. And it also means with a hex bar, you can play around with where your hips are. If your hips are lower or hips are higher, you've got a bit more freedom there. So you can sit a little bit more upright, a bit more like a squat, especially if you're using the slightly higher handles, you'll be able to sit a little bit more upright. So you can play around with that. So I think it wouldn't be a bad thing at all to start with a hex bar and then progress to, I would go hex bar with the higher handles, and then go hex bar with the lower handles, and then maybe go into like a deadlift rack pull or a deadlift off a plate. Or if you've got great mobility and you're confident with the movement, then deadlift with a barbell from the floor. But you do have to think about, okay, the bar needs to be staying super close to you, like up against your shins, and then you need to be able to stand up without the bar kind of hitting your knees or the bar going around the knees, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think you could even regress from the hex bar. You could even regress from that and just do a dumbbell deadlift just to work on the hip hinge, or you could do a kettlebell deadlift as well, because then you've got a little bit higher handles and you could work on the hip hinge from there as well, or just teach a kettlebell swing. That's one of the hardest exercises to teach if somebody's never done a kettlebell swing. It's like it's a great way to learn the hip hinge, though. It's a tough one, though.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, at some point, you're going to have to learn how to do a barbell deadlift, to be honest. Like, okay, you don't have to, but there's certain barbell exercises that would be beneficial for you to learn how to deadlift a barbell properly. For example, a barbell row. Like, if you're going to do a barbell row, you're going to have to deadlift the bar up, and it's nice to know how to do that in a safe fashion. Okay, you're not going to be using anywhere near as much weight to do a row as you are to do a deadlift. But if you're talking about, like, confidence in building up your strength in the deadlift, maybe even go back and say, why are you doing this? Are you doing this to build strength and doing this to build strength in the deadlift? Then yes, I would use that as a progression to go the hex bar or the trap bar, same thing, and then high handles, low handles, and then barbell. And obviously keeping your back straight. With the hex bar, you'll be able to keep your hips a little lower, but it might be beneficial for you not to do that too much, because when you go to a barbell, you're not going to want to have your hips too low, like a squat. You're going to want them a bit more like a hip hinge. If your goal is to build the glutes or the hamstrings, there might be other things that are better off for you. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't still learn that basic movement of a deadlift. But if you do want to learn a proper hip hinge, Romanian deadlift, mm-hmm. either with dumbbells, probably start with dumbbells. A Romanian deadlift is going to really build the hamstrings beautifully, way more than a regular deadlift, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then glutes as well, really.
A Romanian deadlift
with a bit more of a deep end.
I like teaching the Romanian deadlift just because most people do care about strength and also aesthetics. So, you know, if you're doing a Romanian deadlift, you can also get really, really strong doing an RDL. And so it can also be a strength exercise. It's not a powerlifting exercise, though. Like, if you're doing an RDL, you can get to a point where you're loading up a ton of weight to load up the glutes and load up the hamstrings, and you're getting hypertrophy benefits. You're building those muscles up, and you're getting stronger too. So for me, I prefer an RDL just because the deadlift for me is so taxing on my central nervous system. It's taxing from a recovery standpoint. And for me personally and my goals, like, my goal is not to be a power lifter or get strong as hell in these compound lifts. My goal is to build muscle, to get strong and feel better. So for me personally, I like doing RDLs. And I don't actually deadlift the weight up for a barbell RDL. What I actually do is I will pull it out of the squat rack and just RDL from there. So that way I'm not pulling the weight up from the floor, because that can be really, really taxing as well. And you just won't be able to get as many reps close to failure if you do that. So that's what I do, and that's what most of my clients are after, is hypertrophy benefits as well as strength. And, you know, a lot of them are not looking to compete in powerlifting anytime soon. So we mostly focus on the RDL if we're going to do a deadlift, if we're going to do some form of deadlift or stiff leg.
Yeah. I mean, generally, I call stiff leg and Romanian pretty much the same thing, honestly. Yeah. But, yeah, I agree with you on that. Sometimes I'll do deadlifts. Like, if my coach programs deadlifts for me, I'll do them because he programs them. But what I found was they were fun for a while, but then it got to the point where, like, I was doing like sets of four or something with like 385 to 395 pounds around there. And okay, it's not like significantly heavy in comparison to like a bunch of people that do powerlifting, but like, the amount of time it takes just to get to working weight, you know, and the amount of plates you have to load up just to get to the working weight.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I can't even be bothered with all that, you know? And it's like, my main goal is to just build muscle. Strength, okay. But my main goal is to build muscle and get a nice curvature on the hamstring.
Yeah, I mean.
You know what I mean?
I mean.
Don't lose fat. Don't lose fat, not curves, innit? You know what I mean?
Isn't it? Yeah, I think if you build a significant amount of muscle, there's almost no way that you're not going to build strength in the process. There's almost no way that you're not going to also get strong. So, and strong is such a relative term too, because it's like, yeah, maybe we're not squatting 800 pounds, right? But it's like, if you build up to a, you know, 315 pound hack squat, I think I saw Austin in his stories hack squatting like,
yeah,
like four plates per side. I was like, what the fuck, dude? That kid is so strong. So yeah,
he is very strong.
That's beast mode. I wouldn't be able to do that.
But
he's been training consistently for quite a while too. So very, very disciplined kind of dude. I think that most people who want to build muscle will also get very strong in the process. It's almost like you can't not get strong also by building muscle.
Yeah. And the thing is, you will get stronger by having bigger muscles. And one way to get stronger is by getting bigger muscles, because like, the more muscle fibers you have, which is hypertrophy, that is what hypertrophy means, it's like you are getting more muscle fibers and bigger muscles, the more potential you are to be strong, because the more muscle fibers you have, the more that you can recruit to output force. And so if you have less muscle fibers, you have less potential to be strong.
Yeah, Yeah, 100%.
And then when you're working on strength, you're really just teaching your body how to recruit all of those muscle fibers simultaneously for that type of exercise, for that movement, to lift as much weight as possible.
Yeah, I think a lot of people make those initial like huge strength gains in their central nervous system, their ability to recruit those muscle fibers in the most efficient way possible. So it's like you're going to go up, you know, fucking 10 pounds per week, 20 pounds per week, 40 pounds per week sometimes on these exercises and think that, oh my God, you know, I'm getting all this strength, when really, no, you're just – you're learning how to properly execute the exercise and recruit those muscle fibers maybe that you've never done before. So that is pretty much a good explanation for that. All right, question number two. This is kind of what I wanted to discuss today is metabolic adaptation. I got a question in my story yesterday, and I'm going to see if I can pull it up really quick. Somebody asked me how to avoid metabolic adaptation, and I'm going to give you a little bit of like my answer that I said, and you may have a different answer, Andy, and that's okay. That's why like we're coaches, is because we don't always agree or have the same exact answer on everything. There may be some things that I miss or didn't point out in my answer that Andy maybe can elaborate on. But I think that the term metabolic adaptation is thrown around a lot. People throw it around a ton. People say, oh, you know, if you go too low on your calories, your body's going to adapt and you're going to slow down your metabolism. So ultimately, what metabolic adaptation is basically your body adapts to the amount of calories that you give it. Your body will adapt to the amount of energy that you give it. So let's say my maintenance is 2,000 calories and I start eating 1,200 calories. I'm going to lose a shit ton of weight and probably a lot of muscle, probably a lot of fat in a relatively short amount of time. But what's going to happen eventually is I'm going to hit a plateau. And my body is going to say, okay, you're not going to be losing any more weight because you've only given us 1,200 calories. So now our body's going to adapt and say, well, if you're not going to give us any more food, then we're just going to stop losing weight here. I personally think that what most people are struggling with is not metabolic adaptation. It's actually just their accuracy with tracking and their accuracy with what they're doing. So that was kind of my answer, is like you're kind of smirking right now, but I think where most people think their metabolism has adapted, if they were to go back up to maintenance, they would see that their metabolism has not adapted. They're actually maintaining weight back at maintenance. What actually happened is they were just starting to get sloppy with tracking, not tracking weekend calories, not tracking licks, bites, and tastes. Maybe they stopped using their food scale quite as much. Maybe they started having some snacking and just kind of getting a little bit sloppy with things, because eating 1,200 calories for an extended amount of time is fucking hard to do and mentally taxing. And so your body is smart. It doesn't want to lose weight. Your body wants to remain at homeostasis. Your body wants to stay at the exact weight that it's at right now. It doesn't want to lose weight. And you need to trick your body by going into a slight calorie deficit, by increasing your energy expenditure slightly. So when people say they're metabolically adapted, what it really means is like, no, they just fucking stopped putting in the discipline and hard work and stopped being as meticulous as they were in the beginning. That's kind of what I see with my clients and even with myself when I go into long dieting periods. So that's kind of what I think people are dealing with when they think their metabolism has adapted. What do you think?
Well, I'm smirking because I agree with you, basically. I have a lot of things bouncing around inside my head right now. It's like, where do I start? Because I really agree with the fact of the the thing you say about accuracy. I think that's the thing, really. It's like people are potentially worried about them having metabolic adaptation when actually they're just not tracking their food intake, or they are less active than they were when they first started tracking. You know, calorie expenditure, or the number of calories you burn in a day, is not static. It doesn't stay the same. Like, it depends on how much activity you're doing. It depends on how much food you're eating. It depends on a lot of different things. So it doesn't just stay exactly the same every single day. The other thing I wanted to say is, if, let's say, you're on a weight loss diet and you're losing a pound a week, right? And you lose a pound a week for 3 weeks, and then it suddenly stops. That is not metabolic adaptation. It's either a couple of things. Let's say you lost a pound a week for 3 weeks, and then it suddenly stopped. Why did it suddenly stop? It's not metabolic adaptation. Either you've had a reduction in activity in comparison to what you were doing. You've started eating more food, whether you know it or not, whether that's accuracy tracking or like purposefully you start eating more food, or your body's just holding on to water and that's part of the process, right? Like, if your body was to metabolically adapt to the number of calories that you've been eating, you would see a gradual decline in the amount of weight that you lose. So instead of it being 1 pound a week, it would be like pound a week, 0.8 pound a week, 0.8 pound a week, 0.7 pound a week, and it would be gradual. But the thing is, the biggest changes in, or the biggest impacting, the biggest things to impact metabolism and metabolic adaptation is, you know, first of all, body weight. So if you think about, like, if you're a 200 pound person and you lose 20 pounds, you're now 180 pounds. You are going to be burning less calories per day at 180 pounds than you are at 200 pounds because you weigh less. Like, you going up two flights of stairs, 20 pounds lighter, and you doing that, you know, day in, day out, you know, just general daily tasks, your body doesn't need as many calories. And you know, that's why kids have so much bloody energy, is because they weigh like 30 pounds. It doesn't take as many calories for them to dart around literally all day. You know, like for us that weigh like 200 pounds, it's like, that's very energy costly for us to do that, you know? So the biggest changes in metabolism is like, okay, you weigh less, whether that's body fat or like if you lose muscle, God forbid, you know, if you weigh less, it's going to take less energy in calories to perform that activity. The other thing is exercise or non-exercise activity is where, as you get further into a diet, your body will start to slow things down slightly. But I honestly don't think that for most people this is so much of an issue. But your non-exercise activity, so your daily fidgeting, your moving around, you know, being charismatic when you talk or whatever, you know, just general fidgeting and that, housework, whatever, those small movements will decrease as you get further into a diet because your body is trying to conserve energy. Because your body is having to draw on its own stores and your body wants to, like from an evolutionary perspective, wants you to save that stored energy for famine, potentially, you know? So like your body will slow down what it can so that you're generally just moving a little bit less. And you may not even notice that you're doing that. But most people think that it's your metabolic adaptation is down to your basal metabolic rate, your BMR, but it's actually things that you can more so control, to be honest.
Right. But and if you keep, so if you're keeping track of your steps, this will ensure that your body doesn't just downregulate and eat. if you're keeping track of your daily steps, then, and you make sure that those are consistent, then most people are not going to have like a huge down regulation in their NEAT, as long as they're aware of what's happening and they have a step target that they hit daily.
Yeah. Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. But then also, like, I do think that there was a study of like why people are able to, some people are able to maintain weight and eat way more calories than others. And it was like a genetic factor when it comes to their NEAT. And some people are just genetically predisposed.
Yeah.
No, predisposed to fidgeting and stuff, right?
I saw that study as well. And I agree with you, but I also think that this study was done before we had like fitness trackers and were able to really keep track of our steps. And these are probably people that are not like tracking steps in general. So even though like I do agree, I think that there is some genetics at play for sure. Like we all remember that fidgety kid in our math class who couldn't sit still. And then they were never overweight. Like the kid who had ADHD who was in our math class who could never sit still, he was never overweight. It was always some skinny kid who was just like, just all crazy, cracked out. It was always that kid, right? It's because he had a genetic predisposition to higher NEAT. But now that we're older and we track our steps and stuff, I think that we have a little bit more data on that stuff as well.
Yeah, no, I do agree with you, but I do think like you could go for 10K steps, but then you could still not knowingly fidget a little less, and that still might play a part. But I honestly think that what you outlined before is like it's not as big of an issue as what people think, and for the most part, unfortunately, I think people end their diet or they give up their diet way before they would kind of reach any point of metabolic adaptation.
Oh, yeah. Really. Yeah.
You know, like a 12-week cut, unless you're super lean, like the leaner you get, the more you're going to get impacted by this kind of thing. And really, we're not talking about people that are going to step on stage at like single digit body fat. We're talking about like regular people between like, I don't know, anything from 10 to 30% body fat, I suppose. You're not in a 12-week period, you're not going to have too much, if any, metabolic adaptation that can't be overcome by making sure you're dialed with your nutrition, just adjusting your calories, you know, making a small calorie tweak and keeping your activity up.
Yeah, and if you're smart with your nutrition, or you have a coach who's programming your nutrition, they know relatively where your maintenance calories are at, you won't really have to adjust your calories many times over a 12-week fat loss phase. You just won't. Especially if you're relatively lean already, you know, and you don't need like huge adjustments. Any coach that is adjusting your calories every single week, they do not know what the fuck they're doing, or they're trying to trick you into thinking that they have some magic formula that they've figured out that's going to help you lose fat at X and X rates. It's gatekeeping bullshit, honestly. And I saw this in the fitness industry when I first got into it. I saw people changing macros and calories on a weekly basis. And really good coaches, really, really knowledgeable people may change your calories once or twice over like a 10-week period. So it's like, obviously it's different for everybody, but there's way less adjustments. Nutrition is very fucking boring. Once you find out your maintenance and your calories, your protein needs, your macronutrient needs, like you won't need to make very many adjustments at all. I have clients who have been with me for years who I have maybe adjusted their calories and protein like fucking 3 times, like maybe. And it was just to, you know, they went into different phases, or, you know, we wanted to go a little bit aggressive because they had less life stuff going on and we wanted to go a little bit more aggressive for a little while. And then they went on vacation, so we went into maintenance. So it's like there's not very many adjustments that need to be made during nutrition. It's just not the case.
And the truth of it is, like, the hard thing isn't the hard thing isn't like getting the perfect macros so that you avoid metabolic adaptation. The hard thing is being consistently hitting your macros anyway.
Yeah.
You know, the part of the big reason why you don't always change macros is like people never really hit their macros anyway. And so it's like working with people to, you know, to get them closer to hitting their macros on a consistent basis and getting them educated on how to track properly and accurately, and holding them accountable to that. And it's not easy. Like, it's not easy. I just told you earlier in the podcast that like my nutrition hasn't been super dialed, and like I could be way more dialed than I am now. And it's like, well, I'm just going to start changing up my calorie and macro expenditure or intake. Sorry. It's like, no, you work on trying to hit your numbers. And that's the hardest part. It's not about figuring out the most perfect macros for you to avoid metabolic adaptation.
Yeah, it's like people have all these calculators and they're like, which calculator should I use? Your calculator says this, and Joe Douche over there, his calculator says this. Like, what calculator should I use? They're both around, you know, 200 calories off. I'm like, use any fucking calculator, just get started and then figure it out. Like, you, once you get started, you'll figure it out pretty quickly, whether you're losing a pound per week, 2 pounds per week, whatever it is, or you're losing no pounds per week, you'll figure it out pretty quickly. You just got to take action. People just want to worry about calories and calculations and reps and sets and all this shit. And it's like, no, just do the shit that you can consistently do over time and you will see results. So whether you're eating 1600 calories or 1800 calories, it really doesn't fucking matter. Which one can you stick with for the duration of how long you need to be in a deficit?
Exactly.
Can you stick with 1800 calories for the next year and a half that you know you're going to need to be in a deficit? Maybe you can. Can you stick to 1600 calories for the next year and a half? Maybe you know that you can't. So maybe the 1800 calories is going to go a little bit slower, but you're going to be more consistent with it. And more consistent means faster progress.
Yeah. That's
people don't understand that. They don't understand that.
I think your post the other day that you made about how a real transformation doesn't take 12 weeks. It takes, you know, potentially years. At least a year, really, of hard work. And I think that's so true. And it's like, when people want to have it done in 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they do. You know, of course they do. But it's not as easy as that. There's going to be ups and downs. You've got to figure out what foods you like to fit within your macros. You're going to go over your macros. There's going to be a holiday, vacation. There's going to be birthdays, you know? And it's like, things are going to be, roadblocks are going to be there to get in your way. And that's okay. You know, that's where it's like, you have to play the long game. You can't just give up when it's someone's birthday because you've gone over on your calories. It's like, no, you just keep plowing through and you remind yourself that you're in it for the long haul and don't have this idea of like, okay, 12 weeks and I'm done. It's like, it takes longer than that for you to really establish the habits you need and for you to really come out the other end knowing what foods that you can eat in order to not just make the progress, but maintain the progress afterwards.
Yeah. The 12-week transformation is toxic as fuck. It's toxic bullshit that's been created by the fitness industry to sell coaching programs. Join my 12-week coaching program. It's like, if you expect to make a huge transformation in 12 weeks, your life is going to have to absolutely revolve around that transformation. 100%. That pretty much means you cannot have any missed days. You cannot miss your calories. You cannot miss your steps. You cannot miss any workouts for the next 12 weeks. And 99% of people just cannot fucking do that. You know why? Because we have stress. We have anxiety. We have fucking depression. We have screens. We have dopamine constantly. We have sleep issues. We have fucking constantly being barraged by self-limiting beliefs and our own negative thoughts. Do you really think you can be 100% consistent for the next 12 weeks? Fuck no, you can't. You can't. So that's why I say, give it a fucking year. A fucking year. And then you're giving yourself an actual shot. If after a year you do everything consistently, at least 80%, and you're not seeing results, then I give you permission to give up. Go ahead and give up. If after a year you're 80% consistent and you do everything right at least 80% of the time and it does not fucking work, then you can tell me calorie deficit doesn't work. You can tell me that metabolic adaptation and starvation mode is real and that carbs do make you fat and that detox teas are the way to go and that apple cider vinegar actually burns stored body fat off of your fucking inner thighs. Whatever you want to say. Like, you can tell me all that shit is true if after a year of being in a calorie deficit you don't see the results that you want to see.
Yeah.
Bosh, bosh, bosh.
Bosh, bosh, bosh. Exactly, mate. I did have something to follow up with, but, mate, I can't for the life of me remember it, but I think you nailed it with that one.
Oh, man, I love it, dude. I love what we do. I love that we're able to jump on a podcast and talk about this shit because it's so true, man. And it's not people's fault. It's not like the impatience is like their issue, man. It's these fucking fitness industry, dude. They make money off of people by telling them lies, by selling them like these detox programs. And you look at magazine covers and it's just crazy, dude. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I never used to see so much of this crazy diet culture bullshit until I got on TikTok. Because people used to say it was all over Instagram, but for the most part, I followed good people on Instagram, so I didn't really see too much of it. But when I got on TikTok and I saw all the crazy shit that people are recommending in videos, and I'm just like, oh my God, dude, diet culture is alive and well, and we need to fucking make content that's helpful. So
yeah, it's sad, honestly. I remember what I was going to say then. I was listening to, actually kind of embarrassed to say this, but I was actually listening to a couple of podcasts that were made by six-figure coach guru type people. And for people, if you're listening, it's for people that try and get online coaches to earning six figures, basically. And so I was listening to a couple of podcasts because Jeff and I and Austin, we're all in a mentorship with Jordan Sire and Mike Vacanti. And it's very much not a sales emphasis mentorship. It's much more about creating systems and processes to actually help your clients and, you know, mindset about helping clients. And it's an awesome place to be. We're really lucky to be there. Mm-hmm. But there's other mentorships and other masterminds that is solely based on sales. And it's solely based on how many people can you get on the phone? How many people can you sell to? And going back to what you said about the problem with the fitness industry with the 12-week thing is, what I've heard from listening to the couple podcasts that I listened to, it's like they're trying to get as many people on the phone and they're trying to sell as many $1,500 to $2,000 packages in a month as possible for a 12 to 16-week plan. And they are just constantly going through that same cycle. And the impression that I got is like, I don't think that they get many return customers. I think that they're just always focusing on trying to get new customers. And it just goes, it's like, okay, sign you up, 12 weeks, go, give them your shit program, next person. You know, it's like, sign the next person up. Well, you want to give you a wicked program? You don't want to pay this much? Come on, were you bloody poor? Sign them up. 12 weeks, you know, and it's like, it's all about the sales and not about like the follow through and about the actual coaching. And it's like, it's all about the sales tactics. It's kind of like, although I think you and I have both got like better or more comfortable at selling ourselves and selling our services to people that actually are crying out for help or that like are interested in what we have to offer, this is much more cutthroat. Like, how can you overcome objections? It's like, I'm going to force on you. I'm not going to let you hang up the phone until you've bought my product. And it's like, this kind of doesn't sit too well with me. You know, And it's all about like get them in the door, get them out of the door, onto the next person. And that's where this 12-week thing probably comes from. It's like sign up for my 12-week plan, get a great transformation, ruin your life, and then off you go. And then come and find me and Jeff and Austin. You know what I mean? So
I actually was I followed this one coach, and this was in the very beginning of my fitness journey. I followed this coach, and he had this program called 20 in 20. And it was a Facebook group, and it was 20 pounds in 20 days. That's what he was claiming. He was claiming that you will lose 20 pounds in 20 days or your money back. And it was $20. Okay. So, and this guy had hundreds of thousands of followers. And so, and I was at the time, like, I wanted to learn from him how to build a sustainable fitness business. I saw that he had a lot of followers. I didn't know about his business practices. I just saw that he clearly knew what he was doing because he was getting a lot of clients and a lot of engagement, and I wanted to learn. I was young and dumb at the time. I didn't know any better. So I was like, okay, let me see if this guy's getting people results. He's constantly posting testimonials. You know, he's helping people. And I'm like, cool. Let me go see what he's doing. So I went into his Facebook group. He gave me access to it, and he gave me his guidelines for the challenge, the 20 in 20 challenge. When I tell you that this was the most restrictive, insane fucking diet I've ever seen in my life, no wonder these people are losing 20 pounds in 20 days. He had them fasting for 72 hours a week. They were doing 500 calories worth of cardio on the treadmill every single day. They were eating only, they were limited to 50 grams of carbohydrates per day. And if for whatever reason you cheated and you had over 50 grams of carbs, you would have to go into a 48-hour fast. And he sold them supplements. He sold them his own brand of supplements that looked like he made them in his basement. It was very fucking sketchy. And he said, you don't have to work out. You just have to walk 500 calories on the treadmill at an incline every single day. And basically eat. I averaged out the amount of calories that he was giving people. And it averaged out to about 400 to 600 calories per day. When you look at all the fasting and shit, and you averaged out the amount of calories per day. So when I saw this, I was in shock, dude. I was in shock because I was like, this is what the fitness industry is like. So I got an early experience with like that shit. And of course, people saw results. Of course, people started dropping pounds and they were super motivated, right? But what is the long-term damage of doing something like that? It's crazy. So I learned that pretty early on, that people were doing this kind of shit in the fitness industry and kind of what to avoid. Needless to say, I quickly fucking stopped following this guy and stopped, you know, looking to him for guidance. But the toxic shit is alive and well.
You know, people would do that, right? Do the 20 pounds in 20 days or like whatever they lose. Obviously, they're going to lose a lot of weight. And I don't know, maybe it's not a long enough time for them to really feel the negative benefit, the negative side effects of being in that steep of deficit for that duration. Maybe they don't feel the lethargy and that yet. But when they come out the other end, and it's obviously not sustainable. They can't keep up with that. And they don't have the habits in place to even maintain what they've achieved. And they go back to their regular life and way of eating and they gain all their weight back. They probably have in their mind that, oh, I need to go back and do that same thing again because that's what worked.
That's what worked. Exactly, dude. That's what I meant about the gatekeeping thing on the information on the fitness, right? He wasn't teaching people about a calorie deficit. He was actually teaching people about hormones and fasting and insulin and all this shit. And it's like, no, hormones and fasting and insulin is not why people were losing weight. It was because you put them into a extremely aggressive calorie deficit. That if they were to do that for more than 20 days, I can almost guarantee they would experience like hair loss. They would experience hormonal issues. They would start to experience some very, very poor issues with their health if they were to do that for extended lengths of time.
Yeah. Super sad, honestly.
It is sad.
Whenever I'm at the grocery store and I'm like waiting to pay, and like I'll see the Women's Health magazine, Women's World or Women's Health, whatever it is, and it's like always on the front cover, something stupid like 40 pounds in a month, or like I lose 12 pounds this weekend. And it's like, oh, give me a fucking break with this bullshit. It makes me sick. Honestly, it makes me feel fucking sick. I'm sick to my teeth with it. I'm fucking fed up with the bullshit. Absolutely fed up with it.
That's why we need to keep going and doing what we do, man.
I know. And you know what, mate? And I've battled with this in the past of like feeling like I'm the diet culture person. And like when I see people like who have on their profile like, oh, you know, I'm against diet culture, love your body, and you know, don't need a change and all that. And I'm like, I sort of feel like, am I this person that's like creating this diet culture, like,
yeah.
And then I'm like, no, it's like this fucking fitness, women's fitness world, and these coaches that are selling you the 12-week plan that's like not sustainable and shit. And it's, and of course, like the people that are like, love yourself for who you are and whatever, like that's a different story. Like, of course you should love yourself for who you are, but if you can still lose weight and focus on being healthy and stuff, like, anyway, but still, like, the state of the industry is fucking mental. I apologize for effing and blinding left, right, and center, but, like, gets me riled up, something chronic.
Nah, it's fucked up, man. It's a fucked up thing, but we're here to change it. If you're listening to this podcast and, you know, you're part of our squad, and we'll never steer you astray with some bullshit like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, we're here to help.
Cool, man. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. We've exhausted our topics and our resources for the week. Austin Chan is riding Superman right now with a massive glute pump. And we're going to be signing off. We'll see you guys next week.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.